Hello, everybody. This is Steve from Diecast Movie Podcast. Just to remind everybody that Monster Bash, it's just around the corner. It's going to be October 13th through the 15th, 2023. And Gregory Moffitt, who you're going to be hearing my interview with in just a minute, is going to be there too. So hopefully you come out to see him and a lot of other people. And if you're wondering who's all going to be there, you can go back and listen to the episode just before this one where Ron Adams and I talk about who's going to be coming to Monster Bash, and we discuss the movie Dr. X. Also, you can listen to the promo for Monster Bash, which I'm going to be playing in just a second. So I hope everybody enjoys this interview with Gregory Moffitt. And now we'll go to the promo for Monster Bash and straight into the interview. Enjoy.
Here comes Monster Bash to the Marriott Pittsburgh North this October 13th, 14th, and 15th. Guest movie and TV stars signing autographs, 150 vendor tables of cool, new, and vintage Monster movie merchandise, toys, model kits, Monster magazines, comics, DVDs, Blu-rays, VHS tapes, T-shirts, and so much more. Guest stars signing autographs include Greg Moffitt from the low-budget classic Robot Monster, The Adventures of Superman, Science Fiction Theater, and more. Linda Miller, the star of King Kong Escapes, and featured in the cult classic film The Green Slime. Carl Craig, child star of the Gamera Japanese Giant Monster Fest, Destroy All Planets. Tony Isabella, iconic Marvel Comics writer and editor, known for Dracula Lives, Ghost Rider, The Amazing Spider-Man, Tales of the Zombie, and more. Xander Vorkov, star of Dracula vs. Frankenstein, will be bashing
the 1970s Dracula.
TV horror host favorites, Ohio TV legend Son of Ghoul, plus Drac and Countess Carita. Meet them all, see special events, talks, and shop wall-to-wall monster movie collectible vendors. Admission is $25 a day or $60 for the whole weekend of entertainment. Discounts available in advance online at monsterbash.us or creepyclassics.com. It's Monster Bash, October 13th through the 15th, 2023, at the Pittsburgh Marriott North in Cranberry Township, Pennsylvania. Don't scare miss it.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Diecast Movie Podcast. And today I'm going to be doing an interview where I'm joined with Gregory Moffitt, who a lot of you might remember from Robot Monster, Let's Dance, also in an episode of Adventures of Superman, besides many other things. How are you doing today, Greg?
It's a great day thus far. Thanks for asking.
And I'm going to say I'm looking forward to finally getting to meet you at this year's Monster Bash, October 13th through the 15th, 2023, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I think it's your second time coming to Bash, correct?
I think it's my third. I worked one summer festival, or Bash, and I worked one fall Bash in October. One was, 2015, and the other maybe 2016 and 2018. I'm not quite sure about the dates, but I've worked both of those dates. Ron does two dates a year, it seems to me, at least in Pittsburgh he does.
Yes. And so this will be your second October one, and this will be cool because I finally get to meet you. And it's one thing, it's great to be able to interview you, but it's another thing when I finally get to meet the people that I interview, it's even better.
Well, those of us you interview probably feel the same way. It'll be nice to put a face on your voice for me.
That is true. And when you go to the Bash, when you go to different conventions or the Bash in particular, what's it like for you, you know, so your fans have an idea what to expect?
Well, you know, in terms of my life, these kinds of shows are relatively new to me. I never did anything like this until 2008, and I got some kind of backdoor invitation to the Memphis Film Festival through a guy that had done an online internet interview for his internet magazine with me. And a few months after he finished the interview, he called me up and asked me if I'd ever been to Memphis, and I said no, and he said, how'd you like to go? And I said, talk to me. He explained the situation. Of course, I still had no idea what to expect. I never went to an autograph show of any kind, let alone once where I was a featured member of the group. So when somebody told me to bring lots of pictures, I said, where do I get them? And I forget who, but they said, that's up to you to go get them. You can get some shots from all of what you did. I said, man, now that stuff's forever ago. Oh, where do I find this stuff? And they said, well, you know, it's all over YouTube. It's all over the internet. If you have copies of stuff, you can make screenshots and get those copied. And so I went that through that. Fortunately, I had about a four-month warning about going to Memphis, so I had an opportunity to put a batch of photos together. But it just blew me away that people would actually pay me for a picture of me and with my signature on it. I couldn't almost believe it. And it was amazing, actually. And since then, of course, I've been to, where else have I been? I went to Metropolis one year for the Superman show they do in June every year. And this will be my third time at the Bash. I've been to several events for an online group called The Adventures Continue. It's a group of people that love the George Reeves Superman.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I worked the Monster Palooza earlier this year, along with the Hollywood show. Those were first for me working in a relatively large city. You know, the Monster Palooza is a long time event out in LA. And the people were just amazing. And actually, they have been everywhere I went. I don't think I've found friendlier people than I have in Pittsburgh ever. But there's no shortage of the same kinds of folks in L.A. or any place else I've been invited. I'm still rather amazed.
Well, I think,
to tell you the truth.
I think a lot of times people, they saw you in your different shows that we're going to talk about, and they get a chance to hear your stories about what was it like to be, you know, working with certain actors or actresses or doing different productions. And then, you know, and you get a chance to share those stories. And of course, I'm sure that very first convention you went to, it probably was like daunting because you weren't sure what to expect from the convention goers, you know, like, what are they going to be asking me? What are they going to expect from me? And now you kind of have a very good idea.
Well, yeah, it's better than I did the first time, but I didn't really agonize over what they would ask me. I just, I wondered how they would receive me. When I got to the Superman Festival, one of the first fellows I met walked up to me and started reciting my dialogue to me from the episode I was in. And if I had a problem with anything in any of these shows, it was my memory. You know, all of this is 70 years plus ago for me. And that's not just a couple of weeks, you know.
People can't even remember what they had for breakfast that day. You know, you're asking somebody, well, what did you do 70 years ago?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, the exercise over time has really opened my memory to events, conversations, pictures, locations that I had either forgotten or put way deep in my memory. And slowly but surely, some of them come back, and I share the stories, and then I wonder if I got it right. You know, did I remember that conversation correctly? Did I say anything different about it in a previous interview? You know, I worry about contradicting myself from time to time, but I just have to trust the memory I have and the ones I recall to get answers. Yeah, probably the most difficult part of showing up for me.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not like you're at court being sworn in for testimony. You know, you can be off a little bit, but as long as it's generally there, I think you're good to go. I mean, nobody's expecting you to be 100% perfect.
Yeah, and my career was pretty much done in show business when I was 12 or 13. So, and I didn't continue in the business in any way the entirety of my life afterwards. So relationships with other actors and producers and directors and stuff were completely limited to my time as a youngster in front of those people. People have talked to me about how Phil Tucker treated me in Robot Monster. And I'm still trying to put a face on what Phil Tucker looked like. If I didn't have a picture of him in a cast photo, I probably wouldn't know him at all. So in any case, that's what happens when you're 10, you just forget stuff.
Oh, exactly. Or I don't care what age you are. Just the passage of time does make that a little more harder to recall everything. But one thing I want to ask you, what got you started and wanting to be an actor? Was it your parents? Was it something you saw and you decided you wanted to do, or was it a little bit of both?
Both of my folks, my dad from Indiana and my mom was from Oregon, they both came to Southern California to get involved in the entertainment business. My mom was a classical dancer. My dad was a musician with a marvelous voice and a 6-octave range. And he loved harmony music a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And although both of them did manage to get parts in motion pictures, they didn't last long because, unfortunately, they got married. And young women in those days that were under contract didn't see a lot of work if they were married because by being married and that information being public, they couldn't really develop a male fan base out there that would help sell tickets down the road.
Well, that's the shame, because they still could, but I guess, the perceived notion was, oh, if they're single, the guys would be like, oh, we can date her down the road if we ever had a chance to run into her.
Well, a lot of things were very different in the 30s when my folks came to Hollywood in the motion picture business, for sure. The various studios had pretty much total control over the actors and actresses.
I was going to say, your father, he was singing. Didn't he get to work with Billy Burke?
Well, the story goes that when he was in high school, in his senior year, Billy Burke had a touring show, touring burlesque show that came through his small town in Indiana. One of the singers in their group got ill, and they held auditions in the city to work a couple of shows while they were there. And my dad got the job. Well, they loved him so much that Billy came to him after the last performance and said, "Have you any interest in pursuing a career in show business?" And he said, "I'm not sure I understand." And she said, "Well, our tour ends up back in Los Angeles in about 4.5 months. And we'd really like you to join the troupe and finish the tour with us. And you'll be in LA when you get through." And of course, it's either there or New York City. That's where the action is. And he was 6 weeks from graduating high school, and he said, "Let's go." So, in any case, that's how he got to Hollywood. My mom just took the train.
Everybody has different routes. And so your parents were both in the business at one shape or form during their lifetime, and then you come along and your sister Sharon – and you both ended up being child actors. Was it something like your parents, like I said, did they push you guys to go for it? Like, did they say, "Oh, let's try," or you just both had that tendency to go to say, "Oh, let's try this"?
Well, if you remember the history, the early history of show business that goes back as far as burlesque, You'll remember many of the great stars from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s were children of people that worked on the stage before. Typically, they were called show business families. And you tried to keep as many people in the family working at the same time as possible so you could pay the bills. And that's kind of the way it was for us. Sharon got her first role in a film at the age of 11 months. She didn't work again for a couple of years. But when she was about six, I think, if I remember right, she made a film with RKO. And when the film was finished, they signed her to a 7-year deal. They really liked her, and she had a lengthy career with them. She was by far the best performer of any of us in the family, both in terms of the meat and potatoes that she put on the table and in terms of recognition in later years. When I came along, my mom had gotten a phone call one afternoon about an hour before I came home from kindergarten from our agent at the time. His name was Jack Fife. He worked for the Paul Koner agencies in L.A. And he asked her, Mom had turned into a stage mother, of course, by that time. Jack called my mom and said, do you know any young kids, 5, 6, 7, or 8, that have the coloring of Betty Hutton? Blonde hair, blue eyes, etc. And she said, no, because she'd been on sets, you know, working with other children for years at that point in time. And so she said, and I actually had one role before. I had a speaking part in one of Sharon's films about 2 years before that. I was four.
I think that was The Judge Steps Out, right?
I believe that was the film, yes. They didn't have enough kids for a birthday party scene, and Mom said, yeah, you can use Butch to get in the scene, but he has to have a line. And the director looked at her, and she said, I want him to join Screen Actors Guild, and he needs a line. And he said, okay. And so my line was, can I have a piece of cake? Now, I was uncredited in the film. I wasn't given screen credit, but I did make my first deposit to Social Security in 1947. The day my agent called Mom, I came home from school and walked through the door, and she took one look at me and one look at the phone, and she took another look at me, and she said, you want to go be in another movie? And I said, okay. And she called Jack back, and they arranged a screen test. They sent a couple of still pictures of me. My guess is they really liked my coloring, because I did look a lot like Betty. And I did the screen test, and they hired me. After the movie, they put me under contract for a couple of years, which was cool. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Now, that movie, it was Let's Dance, and
yes.
I was going to say, you got to work with Betty Hutton. I watched that movie, and the two of you do look like mother and son, you know, so it does work out with the coloring and everything else. And so, I don't know, and you also got to work with Fred Astaire, which your mother got to work with back in the day, back in Flying Down to Rio. So it's kind of funny how you both had the same connection with Fred Astaire in your movie work and that kind of stuff. So do you have any memories of working with Betty Hutton or Fred Astaire or other people that were on the movie?
Oh, yeah. Several memories from that film. Most of them revolve around scenes that we shot. There was a scene where Betty's trying to kidnap me from Grandma's house.
Mm-hmm.
And she puts me in a laundry bag, and we climb down a railing outside of the bedroom window and walk across the lawn and walk through a rock garden pool. It was exciting because they had to go get a different pair of shoes for me, so I didn't screw up the ones that fit me. They got one that were two or three a pair that was two or three sizes bigger for me to shoot that scene in, so it didn't ruin the shoes for the, for other upcoming scenes.
Mm-hmm.
That was one. Oh, the scene. Since you've seen the film, you've seen the Jack and the Beanstalk routine that Fred did.
Oh, yes.
That was amazing. That whole scene. I had never seen a process stage before then. And watching them lip sync to the music that they had recorded prior was really an interesting process for me. I'm sitting there listening to the dialogue come through the microphones and watching Fred lip sync it. And it was, you know, he was flawless. And I did my dialogue live in the shots. They didn't record anything for me. But they did that in several scenes that I got an opportunity to watch, you know, where they would actually record the audio before they shot the scene. Because the dance scenes are so exhausting, you know, it's hard to tell what the quality of the dialogue is going to be like when you get through. And by 47, let's see, Astaire was probably in his late 30s, maybe early 40s. Hard to say. But in any case, he'd been around for a minute or two then. So my guess is they just didn't want to take any chances with it, and that's how they approached making it work. Later on, I saw more process stages and some work I did at Universal and with Superman, but it was the first for me in Let's Dance.
Yeah, I think Fred Astaire was born in 1899. So he would have been in his later 40s. At that time. So, but I mean, obviously in excellent shape and usually able to perform and all that stuff. So it's hard to say. As you were saying, what good the quality would be. And it's just like with music videos nowadays, where you see everybody dancing and doing all this other stuff, it's best to have the vocals be solid. So if you tape it ahead of time, that way people can enjoy the performance and then they could lip sync it with the music.
Exactly so. So it was interesting working as a little aside, you know, the shooting schedule is a little over 6 months. We started in, I think, March of 1949 and finished around September or October. And at Christmas time, I got a bicycle from each of them for Christmas. Happy Merry Christmas from Fred and Merry Christmas from Betty. Well, it was apparent that Betty was trying to be very nice. She sent a top-of-the-line Schwinn 26-inch bike, and I couldn't even reach the pedals. And Fred sent a 20-inch bike, which was the perfect size. So actually, Sharon rode the big bike for the first couple of years. And I had the little bike. But it was wonderful that they remembered me. I was quite surprised. Betty and my mom remained friends until my mom passed back in the late 80s.
That's just kind of funny. And they both thought to send you bicycles. So it's just kind of, you know, ironic. I guess maybe during the movie, you probably said you wanted a bicycle one time and they both heard it and, you know, they decided to go with it or who knows.
Yeah, I don't know what the, where the idea germinated, but it apparently the same idea hit both of their minds. And the surprising part to me was that they would, one, they would remember, and two, they would do anything at all about it. Anyway, I was just blown away. I got a bicycle from Fred Astaire and another one from Betty Hutton? You got to be kidding me. Anyway, it was an exciting Christmas at our house, you might guess.
And I'll say, and your sister gained for a while too, because she got around your one bike for a while, but until you aged into it or grew into it. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I guess it was probably, might've been during the contract that I had with Paramount. I don't know if I was, if they had to approve television appearances or not, but I knew that there was no way I could work in motion pictures unless they had a term for it called loan me out to another studio. Mm-hmm. And I did a couple of those, one for Universal, a film called Saddle Tramp was the name of it, with Joel McRae and Wanda Hendrix.
Yeah, you played Butch.
In that film, yeah.
So what was it like working with Joel McRae?
You know, my memory there is a little shaky. I have memories there, but not so much of working with the stars, but events. As I mentioned before, the idea of a process stage, they had one scene set up in a process stage with a buckboard that we were supposed to be traveling in, going down the road, bumping all over the place. And me and my three brothers were in the back of the buckboard getting bounced around, but there were no horses in front or anything. You know, it was all coming from machinery under the stage. And it was gentle enough that we weren't hurt, but it was violent enough that we bounced around enough. You know, for us, the hard part for us was to keep from laughing because it was fun. Well, you know what I'm saying? A completely different experience for me. And Jimmy Page was one of the kids. And I'm trying to remember the name.
Orly Lindgren. And Gordon Gerbert.
And Gebert. Gebert. How you said he.
I'm sorry.
Gordon Gebert, yeah. Those were the other two. And we may have shot that more than once because we started laughing.
So you had an amusement park ride, in a sense, as you were doing it, because, you know, it's bouncing you around. You guys are enjoying it just like it would be if you were on a Disney World ride.
Yeah, and of course, we never did take the long road that they showed in the movie at all. We hopped into the buckboard with Joel, and we went, well, I don't know, maybe 20 yards, and they cut. And then they inserted they inserted the scene from the process stage, and then they showed us arriving wherever it was at the end of the scene. Mm-hmm. And we were back on the buckboard for that, but not through the bouncy part of the trip at all. There was also there was a scene in the film where we're sitting around a table and we're eating fried chicken.
All right.
And we shot the scene in the morning. And we were on location. I don't remember, Corriganville, maybe, was where we were shooting. That's kind of my memory, but I'm not positive. And there were, you know, two or three options for shooting Westerns in those days, exteriors for Westerns. Anyway, so we're on location, and they brought us lunch. Guess what they brought us?
Chicken?
Fried chicken, of course. and we'd been gnawing on pieces of fried chicken all morning, you know, setting up all the different shots, the different angles, the headshots, the group shots, etc. And we always had to be eating in all the shots. I'm not real sure I ate a whole lot of my lunch that day.
You'd think they would have thought, like, oh, these kids are eating chicken the whole time. We should just, but I guess whoever was in charge of catering that day just didn't think about what you guys were doing prior to it.
Yeah, there was no connection at all. No coordination. That's probably a better way to say it. In any case, at least they brought the lunch, you know.
That's true, and I'm sure there was something else with it besides chicken, so you probably did get a little, you know, like there was probably some sides and other stuff. So
potato salad, corn, and stuff like that, sure, probably. In any case. But those are the two biggest memories I have of that. Well, I got to carry a .22 rifle. I was 6 or 7, I think, maybe. When I made that film, maybe 8. Mm-hmm. And I think I was the littlest of the four brothers, if I remember right. But they in a couple of scenes, I had this 22 rifle. I was blown away.
Well, I can imagine, you know, because being a child of that boy, that age, and you're used to playing, you know, cowboy and that kind of stuff, and here you are getting, you're able to hold the prop rifle.
With a real weapon.
Oh, prop rifles are real. I'm just meaning, what I mean by prop is that it's not live.
Exactly. There was no live ammunition in it whatsoever. And quite frankly, I would guess that they probably took the firing pin out of it as well, but I don't know that for sure.
That still had to be cool, and I'm sure it was a lot heavier than you thought it was going to be.
Yeah. Then I did a couple of science fiction theaters and what was the thing with Brad? What was the name of that show? Well, Brad was a cop.
You're talking about Highway Patrol.
Highway Patrol. And then I did Donald O'Connor's two shows, I think, and Fireside Theater, two or three episodes. I did some commercials. And my life-changing experience working with George Reeves for 4 days, which has brought me untold adoration from all the Superman groupies. And then, of course, Robot Monster. I'm the only one left from the cast and crew in Robot Monster.
Just before we get to Robot Monster,
yeah,
I was going to ask you about Adventures of Superman, because when I grew up, it was always playing in reruns. And
oh, yeah. You're a bit younger than I am.
And the just a little. And you're in the episode, for those wondering, The Stolen Elephant. And
which was not the original title.
Oh, wasn't?
No. The title in the script, or at least in my script, was, are you ready?
All right.
The Purloined Pachyderm.
The Purloined Pachyderm.
Which means exactly, the purloined is stolen. The stolen elephant, yeah. In any case, it came out as The Stolen Elephant. And that's how those who've seen it remember it.
Oh, exactly. And you got, I mean, you had a live elephant there. You know, Margie the elephant playing Susie. You had Superman. I mean, you know, you got to live virtually every child that grew up in that time. And, you know, after that time, you got to be with Superman. You know, even though we know it's George Reeves and it's an actor, for us that are watching it at that time, at that young age, you're with Superman. So.
Oh, yeah. And listen, I lived in L.A. I had seen Superman on TV, probably seen the Kirk Allen serials from the late 40s in the movies on the weekends by then. By the time the series came out, George was the man as far as I was concerned. And working with all of them was amazing, you know, and the questions I get from people about, what was it like to work with George? You know, I was 10, 11, 12, maybe, when I did that work. And not a lot there. He was a wonderful guy. I mean, he treated me with grace and charm. He was very friendly. Interestingly, he called me by that character's name whenever we were, you know, if we rehearsed the scene, it was, okay, Johnny, let's get to work on this, and then we'd go. Any other time, he'd call me Greg. Or Butch. My mom was around, and so people heard her use that name with me, that was my family nickname. Given the state of my hair, I always wondered why they called me Butch, but if you look back at the films, there's hardly anything that looks like a Butch haircut in any of my work.
Well, we'd have to ask your mom. She'd be the only one that would know.
Either she or my dad, and both of them unfortunately passed quite some time ago.
And it's just, I'm going to ask you, though, something different. I mean, you've probably been asked this before, but you got to work with an elephant. Now, did the handler, the elephant, ever let you ride the elephant?
Yes, I did get on the elephant. However, and here's another interesting little factoid. Before they would let me get up there, they gave the elephant a haircut. Elephants grow hair. And when it first comes out, it's as sharp as pine needles. and they gave the elephant a haircut where I would be sitting. But they didn't use scissors. They used a blowtorch.
a blowtorch?
apparently the elephant's skin was so thick it didn't bother it at all. And it was what effectively took the hair off quickly. So it was short and sweet. And I got to get up on top of the elephant and say, giddy up and hi-ho, Silver, and all that.
You got to be Tarzan.
Or the Lone Ranger. I'm not sure which your title.
Well, I was thinking Tarzan because you got to ride the elephant. And then, of course, Lone Ranger what you were saying it. So it's like you've got to be like everybody's little everybody's hero, you know, in that sense. You know, it's, oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. It was all fun, you know, for me. The motion picture business didn't die because I showed up. And that's a good thing.
Now, a lot of people are coming to Monster Bash for one main reason, because you were in a monster movie, you know, back in the day, 1953. This is its 70th anniversary, Robot Monster, which it just came out with. There's a new pristine Blu-ray edition of Robot Monster with the 3D elements restored. And I own it, ladies and gentlemen, so it actually looks really, really cool. You know, you can watch it in 3D or you can watch it in 2D. You do not need a special Blu-ray player or TV in order to do the 3D, though if you have one, it has the capability of utilizing that to its max also.
Yes.
What was it like, you know, being involved with Robot Monster? Because you were basically, and for all intents and purposes, the lead character.
I was what?
I would say you were the lead character for Robot Monster.
Well, I don't think either my mom or I had any sense that that was the case until after the film was completed. I remember my mom saying, you know, you had a lot more to do with that film than I originally thought. And I did appear, you know, with frequency on the screen in the film. And obviously my character was central to the plot. I probably didn't realize I was in a dream sequence until I saw it years later. And I noticed that everybody's outfit, everybody's wardrobe changed the minute I woke up from my nap. I had shorts on, not jeans. Mom's outfit Mom's outfit and my older sister's outfit had changed, and actually they'd become identical to each other. Paula, my younger sister, her outfit had changed. But during the shooting, I never realized that at all.
Yeah, because also the professor and his helper, Roy, became the professor in the dream sequence, became your father, and Roy became an assistant also still there, but also eventually marries into the family. So everybody became related during the course of the film.
Right. Well, during the dream sequence.
Yes. Yeah, except for, of course, Roman. Roman did not become related to you guys.
That was a good thing, yeah.
So what was it like working with Roman? You know, I know because you were young. You knew it was a costume. Yeah. You knew it was making. What was it like for you to seeing that outfit?
Well, you know, George Barrows was the fellow inside the monkey suit, and he was a wonderful guy. He probably lost minimum 10 pounds a day every day that he wore the suit for the 4 or 5 days we were shooting. Would be my guess, wandering around through the Hollywood Hills. Even in early March, it was not cold by any stretch of the imagination in Southern California. And he worked his behind off. But he always had kind things to say, and he had a great sense of humor. In some ways, it made it hard to be afraid of him. But, you know, he would tell me, don't worry about what you have to, what your lines are. Just go ahead and do what the director requires. And and we'll be okay. And I said, yeah, I know. I shared that with him, you know. And he said, that's when he cautioned me. And I said, you know, I know. I'll be good.
So,
in any case.
But what was it? I mean, I know he was great to work with, but I mean, what was your opinion of the costume back then as compared to now? You know,
it's as hokey today as it was the day they shot the film. I mean, an ape suit with a diver's helmet with, what do they call them? Rabbit ears on top for me.
Yep.
a bit strange, but it was a science fiction film, and you just go play what you got to play.
Yeah, and earlier, and I was going to say, before the dream sequence even started, you know, you're playing a spaceman, you know, wearing the helmet and going around
yeah.
and doing your thing. Yeah. They set up all the things where, like, the elements that the dreams would be about with you in the beginning.
There are a lot of scenes that are repeated, or a lot of film clips that are repeated throughout the film. I don't know if you noticed, but when Roman decides to call his boss, every time he walks over to the other side to reset the dials to communicate, they're always in the same place.
Yep.
It's as though he didn't leave them the way they were previously, and every movement he makes in those shots are identical to the previous one. So I know they just use the same footage over and over.
I could tell. It was like when you're, I don't think I caught it the second time, but the third time I was like, okay, they're repeating the use because it's like they're doing the exact same thing again and again, which is fine. It doesn't take away from the movie. It's just because it's they had to do something to pad some of the time because it's only like 66 minutes, 63 minutes long. It's a very short movie.
Yes, it is.
What was it like working with some of the other actors on it? Do you have any memories of working with any of them?
Paula and Claudia Barrett. I have some decent memories with George. Not bad. He was a friendly guy. I don't honestly remember Phil Tucker at all. In terms of his directing or producing, I'm guessing he was probably present in the casting audition, but I don't know that with any certainty. But Claudia was always friendly, and actually Claudia and I went to Monster Bash together one year. That was the first year I worked the summer show. It was great to meet her again. We had met a couple of years earlier at the Egyptian Theater in Los Angeles when Bob Furmanek first showed his first redo of the film in that theater. And, you know, that place sat, I don't know, between 800 and 1,000 on the ground floor, and it was three quarters full. I was just surprised beyond belief. And people were dodging the bubbles and in the theater, and the film was beautiful. It was, you know, the Polaroid edition was just, it was clean and neat. Not as good as the one you're seeing today, but it was very good. But we had an opportunity to talk to the crowd and see each other, and we all went to dinner afterwards, and we spent a fair amount of time together when we were at the bash. We traveled the second leg of my trip. She was on the flight into Pittsburgh. And our first leg on the flight home, she was on my flight back to Phoenix, I guess it was. I picked her up in Phoenix, and on the way home, she got off in Phoenix. She lived out in the desert, not Death Valley, but I'm not exactly sure. I don't recall at this time. She passed away, I think, now about 4 years ago. four or five years ago. But she was a real sweetheart. And the only one I ever met again as an adult.
That's cool that Ron was able to set that up to where you guys got to be together at the same bash and fly out and, you know, get to spend some time together. And to do that, you know, it's, but one of the things I want to bring up is you mentioned his name, Bob Fermanek, who basically spearheaded this restoration of Robot Monster that is going to be shown for people that are coming to Monster Bash. They're going to be doing a screening, I believe it's on Saturday night, in 3D. Ron will be supplying people the 3D glasses so you can watch it in their screen, in their Q&A screening room. So it'd be a nice big screen projection of it, and I'm looking forward to seeing it on the big screen after seeing it on just my TV to compare the differences, you know, with the effects. Can you talk a little bit about Bob and how he was able to help you guys work together to get this done?
Well, as I understand it, Bob was working for Jerry Lewis back in the late 80s and early 90s, harvesting old clips and stuff of his that he'd done, going through the film vaults in Hollywood and New York. And while he was in New York, he had always had, I guess, a soft spot in his heart for Robot Monster. Why, I don't know. But he found, you know, when they sent the movie out for release, there were very few 3D-capable theaters in the country outside of the big cities. So they felt, even though the film was shot using two reels, and to show it in 3D required both reels, they sent out basically a single reel. And he found one that was pretty clean, and he asked if he could continue to look, and they said, yeah. And a few months later, he found the other side, and he determined to try to clean it all up. I guess his company is called 3D Archives, and I'm not sure whether Robot Monster was the impetus to him founding the country or not, company or not, but I think it probably had some impact on his decision. Then he ran into all kinds of ownership problems, who had the title and who had the copyrights and all that. And they went hunting for better copies and finally found them. And they spent quite a bit of time working on them, even after our meeting in, I think it was 2013 or 2014, when we were at the Egyptian. And you see you've seen the result today.
It's a beautiful, crisp copy and everything. It's just wonderful, especially if you go on YouTube and look at something that was done like a clip from it from earlier, and you can just see the difference night and day.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. I have a 2D copy of it that I'd had for years, but I'd never seen it as a kid. My mom would never allow Sharon or I to see anything that we had worked in while we were home. She didn't want us to critique our own performances and to have them on our minds as we did further work. So I never saw the film, let me see, in a theater until we were at the Egyptian. Mm-hmm. I had seen it a few years, in the late 90s. I was managing a bowling center and running a midnight squad of rainbow bowling. I don't know if you know what that is, but they put colored pins in the rack that were worth various amounts of money, depending on where they were in the rack and what you did with the rack, et cetera, mm-hmm. struck or spared. Or, in any case, and we had TVs over each pair of lanes. And I'm calling all the winning shots. And somebody comes running up to me and says, are you in this movie? I said, what are you talking about? And he said, I saw your name in the credits for this movie. Look. And I looked up and there was Robot Monster. And of course, I couldn't pay attention to it then. I was busy working. So, but I had never broadcast my show business history in my adult life anywhere. So everybody was quite surprised to find out that I had that in my background. Everybody that was there that night and had worked with me or been a customer of mine for any length of time at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw it at the Egyptian on a big screen, and it was gorgeous. And I've seen the new one at home on my TV, and I saw a presentation of it in Los Angeles at a big screen right after it was released. Eric Kurland, who runs a website called 3D Space in L.A., he and Bob are quite good friends, and he supervised the showing there. So except for those two instances, I had never seen it on a big screen. And this coming show will probably be time number three on a big screen for me after all these years.
And for listeners wondering, want to know more information about Bob, he's going to be the next episode. Him and I are going to be talking about Robot Monster in more detail, you know, from his point of view and going through all the legwork and about the movie. So this will be a nice companion for it. You're bringing up the knowledge of being in it, and then his knowledge of been bringing about the restoration of it.
Well, he did a lot more work than I did, I guarantee you.
Well, without you in the beginning doing the movie, then he would have nothing to restore. I mean, yeah, come on. We all know it's...
Well, the work involved in reconditioning that film and going, you know, I know nothing about the technology that he has to use and how he does it and how he puts it together. All I can do is comment on the finished product. And if you look at my 2D version and then look at the most current version, the differences are monumental, I guess is probably the best word to use here.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And you were in one other movie that we haven't talked about, and that's another Western, Two Gun Lady.
I have to tell you, I have no memory of that film. Zero. I don't know where it was shot. I don't know who was in it. I see it. I mean, I know that I was in it, but I don't know where. I don't remember any of my part. I don't think I've ever seen the film at all. So I can't really tell you anything at all about it.
Well, for listeners wondering, and this happens when you have a child actor, you know, where things, like we said earlier, remembering stuff from decades ago, you were in it. You did not have a big part. You were one of the town boys, and you have a fight with another town boy who gets to carry somebody's luggage, and you have a little fight going on there, and you get to talk to a couple of the characters, and then you come back at the end. So you probably did a day of filming, maybe two, and then you were done, you know, and you were so. But your part's in the beginning, the very beginning of the movie, and you come back at the very end of the movie.
Did I win the fight?
You know, it ended up being a draw because you guys, as you were fighting, somebody said, well, you're missing your chance to get money from this one person. You both got up and took off running. So you were going, which was the person who ends up being Two Gun Lady, Peggy Castle, is the actress. So okay. You guys ran over to her. So, but you're about 4 or 5 minutes into the beginning of the movie. So it was a good portion of the beginning. You were talking to one of the other main characters, and then the lead character shows up. But but it happens. Nobody can remember everything. It's like, but it is out there for listeners that want to see it. You can find it out there online. If you're curious, it's as a Western, it's a fine Western, you know, it goes through some of the tropes that are normal with it, but it was enjoyable. It was an enjoyable movie. It was a solid movie.
I have tried to go back and find copies of all my work. I've seen Highway Patrol. I've seen science fiction theater. I've never seen episodes that I did with Donald O'Connor. They probably don't exist. If they were done in those at that time, it probably would have been in Kinescope. But I've never seen them. I've never seen, what else? Oh, Two Gun Lady, Fireside Theater. I've never seen any clips from those. Do you know where I can find Two Gun Lady? I guess I can probably look it up on Google it.
When we're done this, we'll talk. When we're done the episode proper, we'll talk about it, and I'll send you the link. You know, and now you can watch it. Oh, no problem. I mean, you know, now when you ended your acting career, like you said, you were, you know, still like what, 11 or 12, 13, somewhere. You were like a preteen age. What did you go and do after that?
Well, my career died primarily because my dad got a job at Hughes Aircraft as an engineer. And they transferred him to a new plant they had in Fullerton, California, right next to Anaheim. And we moved to Anaheim. And Sharon had already flown the coop. She was old enough to go. And so only I was left. And kids' interviews, typically in show business in those days, especially during the school year, were between 3:30 and 5. And I was 40 miles away down the Santa Ana Freeway when it was two lanes each way. And I didn't get out of school until 3. And it was virtually impossible for me to make an interview time. So my career just died on the vine. And I don't think I ever had an overwhelming desire to be in show business myself. I did my mother's and father's bidding in those days, and it was fun. But I never looked backward and tried to go back to Hollywood. I had jobs throughout growing up. I had paper routes. I shined shoes. I was a busboy and a dishwasher in restaurants and a porter in bowling centers. And bowling really trapped me. I got pretty good at the sport and very briefly, bowled professionally. Found out I couldn't cut it. But I did love the business. So I guess for the next 30 or 40 years, I spent a fair amount of time in the bowling business as a manager, various centers throughout Southern California.
That's pretty, I mean, I've bowled since I was, you know, growing up. My middle brother and I, we used to always bowl in different leagues. And, you know, it's one of those fun things to do. And, you know, it's nice when you have the competitive chance to, you know, you get to bowl there, but it's also fun when you get to take your family and go bowling and just have that enjoyment, you know, of a nice relaxing weekend day or whatever, and go and have fun with it. Whether it's 10 pen or duck pen, it's always cool.
I was working at a dinner house as a busboy and dishwasher, and the lady that owned the business, lady and husband, one Saturday night after we closed, she said that there's a new bowling center that just opened up. Let's all go bowling, and it's on me. And so we did. And I got the job because her son, Andy, and I had become good friends in sixth and seventh grade. And so we went to Lynbrook Bowl, and we bowled, and I kind of was hooked. We joined a fall league there for juniors on Saturday mornings, and I carried out 130, and then the next season I carried 155, and I kept getting better, and they had a teacher there that worked with kids. And by the time 1960 rolled around, I was carrying 200, which was, that's a pretty good average for a 17-year-old. Back in those days, scoring was not all that, nothing like it is today in the bowling business, competitive bowling.
Yeah.
And so 200 was kind of a magic number. And so I stepped out and I bowled four PBA tournaments. I cast twice, but I knew I had no shot really out there. The opportunities for West Coast bowlers were limited to where you could bowl in Vegas, L.A., San Francisco, Phoenix. That was about all that was available to you. And I bowled in each one of those once. And as I said, I cashed twice, but not very high. 14th once, I think, and I got a check. And I might have been right on the number the other time and got a check. But I performed reasonably well, especially considering my age and experience. I just didn't think. I had some friends who were far better players than I was. One, a fellow named Barry Asher, who's in the PBA Hall of Fame today. He and I grew up together, and he's a great player. Today, he still carries 220, and he's in his late 70s.
So how many perfect games did you bowl? I have to ask.
I had four that were on telescores, none of them in sanctioned league or tournament play.
That's amazing. The best I ever did was have 10 strikes in a row, and then of course I got 9. I left the dreaded 7 pin. But
there you go. You right-hander or left-hander?
Right-handed.
Ah, okay. Well, you got to be pretty good to get the first 10.
It was fun, you know, and I'm not sure if you, but you don't even know you're doing it until everybody starts not talking to you. And then you realize nobody's talking to you anymore. And that's when you start to wonder why. And you look up and you're like, oh, I have yet to miss. Then of course, it went two or three more frames and then boom, you know, and I finally got the 9. And I was just like, but you don't notice it because all of a sudden everybody just stops talking. And it's just like, wait a minute, why is nobody talking to me? What did I do?
Yeah. And then you look up at the telescore and you see 10 and you go, oh, yeah. Well, I don't think it ever took me that long to realize that I had a big string going. But I never finished it out in a sanctioned event.
Well, still, you had 4 of them, which is 4 more than me, and 4 more than most of the world.
and they all made money. They were in pot games or match games, one way or the other. So I did earn a little something with each one.
And there's one thing I wanted to ask you, because you did work with your sister, at least in one other thing that I know of. I'm not sure if you remember this. There was a radio version of A Christmas Carol where you played Tiny Tim. And you got to work with Sharon. How much do you remember about that?
I was 4 or 5. Not very much at all. If my mom hadn't reminded us from time to time. You know what reminds me of it? What reminds me of it is seeing the old pictures of the Hollywood Christmas parade when they put up the Christmas trees on all the lampposts up and down Hollywood Boulevard. And they had Santa on a sleigh, and I guess they ran the parade 7 or 8 nights in a row. We actually got to get on the sleigh one year, Sharon and I both. And that kind of brings back to me the memory of the, but I have no actual memory of doing the radio show at all.
I think what you remember is probably even cooler, being in the parade with your sister. I mean, that's just something that, as you said, it's still with you to this day. That's probably the best thing of all.
Well, yeah. It's the visuals, you know, seeing the Christmas trees down, up and down Hollywood Boulevard. They were all metal. They glistened. They were green and snowy white with metal balls all over them. And I think they probably still decorate for the Hollywood parade these days, but I don't know for sure.
Well, Greg, I want to thank you for joining me for, you know, this hour and talking about your career and things like that. And And listeners, I just want to remind everybody that he is going to be at Monster Bash this October 13th through the 15th, 2023 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So if you're thinking, Steve, why didn't you ask him about this or that? He's going to be right there. So you can ask him yourself and also get your picture with him, get an autograph. And then on Saturday night, the 14th, October 14th, you'll get to watch Robot Monster in 3D. And then Greg Moffitt and Bob Forniak are going to be there for a Q&A right afterwards. So you can talk to them and ask them questions about the movie and stuff like that.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. Anybody that's listening that's thinking about coming, come on down. We're going to have a good time. 3 days, Friday afternoon, Saturday morning, Sunday morning. And, of course, Saturday night showing the film. It should be a very fun weekend. So I'm hoping that the weather remains good. The last time I worked a fall event with Ron, the weather was terrible. And a lot of the folks who had come any distance didn't because travel was restricted. It was rainy and windy in any case. So I'm hoping for a lot better weather and hoping we get a chance to see more people and more folks get a chance to come visit.
Well, I know I'm going to be there. I'm looking forward to meeting you in person so we can actually I'll get to see your face. You sadly will get to see my face. So, you know, there's a reason I do an audio-only podcast.
You have a face for radio. I pretty much understand.
And my wife will tell me I have the face for radio and the voice for a silent movie. But people listen to it. So.
That's not very fair. Especially if you have a podcast that's working.
It is. Well, most people are tuning in not to hear me. They're tuning in to hear you. So that's the good part.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. And I look forward to meeting you as well this October.
Hello, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the interview. And please leave us feedback at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Facebook page. I again want to thank Gregory Moffitt for letting me interview him. And I'm looking forward to meeting him at Monster Bash. And again, October 13th through the 15th, 2023 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You can go to monsterbash.us for more information. Another thing that people might be interested in is we also do a subsidiary series that's part of the Diecast Movie Podcast feed, and that is Hammerama, where Alistair Hughes and myself talk about Hammer films, and that's going to be coming out again with the next episode soon, where we talk about the Quatermass experiment. It's going to be a few episodes from now. To give you an idea what that's like, I'm going to exit this episode out with the Hammerama promo. Hope everybody enjoys it, and everybody has a good day. And again, thanks for listening.
I'm Al from New Zealand.
And I'm Stephen from Maryland, USA.
We are Hammerama. Welcome to our new podcast, Enter Freely. And of your own will.
Part of the multi-award-nominated Diecast Movie Podcast, Hammerama is a wide look at the world of Hammer horror from either side of the globe.
Each month, we will throw a die to decide which category from the film Vault of Hammer we are going to discuss. The Dracula, Frankenstein, or Mummy Cycles, science fiction, prehistory, or the experimental 1970s.
We will cast our international eyes across then and now reviews of the movie,
its place in the Hammerverse,
our encounters with the stars,
a film poster critique,
and unusual associated merchandise.
So join us for our bite-sized discussion of Hammer's gory glories, stitched together from both ends of the earth.
Hammerama is a proud part of the Diecast Movie Podcast.